This will give you a lot of background, and it is fairly long, so you have to be patient with it. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Visali in the great wood, in the hall with the peaked roof. Now on that occasion, when it was morning, the Blessed One had finished dressing, had taken his bowl and outer robe, desiring to go into Visali for alms. Then, as Satchika, the Nigantha's son, do you know about Sai Baba? Okay, he was considered an Indian saint. He could manifest things like that. He was a Nigantha. And when he say Satchika, the Nigantha's son, it means he was a follower. And was walking and wandering for exercise. He came to the hall with the peaked roof in the great wood. The Venerable Ananda saw him coming in the distance and said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, here comes Satchika, the Nigantha's son, a debater and a clever speaker, regarded by many as a saint. He wants to discredit the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. It would be good if the Blessed One would sit down for a while out of compassion. The Blessed One sat down on a seat made ready. Then Satchika, the Nigantha's son, went up to the Blessed One after exchanging greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, there are some recluses and Brahmins who abide pursuing development of the body, but not the development of the mind. Sounds familiar. They are touched by painful body feeling. In the past, when one was touched by bodily painful feeling, one's thighs would become rigid, one's hearts would burst, hot blood would gush from one's mouth, and one would go mad, go out of one's mind. So when the mind was subservient to the body wielded mastery over it. Why is that? Because the mind was not developed. But there are some recluses and Brahmins who abide pursuing development in mind, but not development of body. They are touched by mental painful feeling. In the past, when one is touched by mental painful feeling, one's thighs would become rigid, one's heart would burst, hot blood would gush from one's mouth. One would go mad, go out of one's mind. Now what he's describing is one-pointed concentration in the extreme. A lot of people, I don't say a lot of people, but people who come and they've been doing one-pointed concentration come complaining to me about ringing in the ears and vertigo. They feel dizzy all the time. They'll sit in meditation and they'll just fall over backwards. Things like that. And that's one of the bad side effects of one-pointed concentration. And there's also people that have gone crazy for a period of time. I mean literally gone crazy. And then they come and they want to know if I can teach them meditation in the right way. And of course I can. And they know they don't have any more problems with that. There was one man that he got into his one-pointed concentration so deeply he was working at, or he was going to school to become a priest. And his one-pointed concentration was so bad he got these massive migraine headaches. And it sent him crazy for a few years. So when I started showing him the relaxed step and what that tight mind was and how to recognize it when it first comes up and what it is, craving, he was very successful with his meditation after he started relaxing more. He was putting in the wrong kind of effort. And he would be studying his books and people would come up and start talking to him and he just didn't know that they were there. And finally they had to close the book on him and then he would start paying attention to what was happening. This doesn't happen with this kind of meditation because it's a softer kind of collectedness that you have in your mind. It is a more aware kind of practice. That you practice not only with your daily activities, but when you get out and you start practicing in your daily life, you gain a lot of insights into the way your mind works. So, when the body is subservient to the mind wielded mastery over it. Why was that? Because the body was developed, Master Gotama, it has occurred to me, surely Master Gotama's disciple abide pursuing development of mind and not development of body. But, Satchika, what have you learned about the development of the body? Well, there are, for example, Nandavacha, and he goes on and he says a bunch of other names. They go naked, rejecting conventions, licking their hands. That's one of the rules of the monks. Monks can't lick their hands when they're done eating. Now, during the time of the Buddha, they didn't have any silverware, so everybody ate with their hand. When they got done, they would lick it off. It's kind of disgusting. And there is a rule that says monks wash their hands. They don't lick their hands. Not coming when asked, not stopping when asked. They do not accept food brought or food specially made or an invitation to a meal. They receive nothing from a pot, from a bowl, across a threshold, across a stick, across a pedestal, from two eating together, from a pregnant woman, they couldn't accept food, that's their convention, from a woman who's giving suck, from a woman in the midst of men, from where there is food is advertised to be distributed, from where a dog is waiting, from where flies are buzzing, and that's hard to be in Asia without being around buzzing flies, or Australia is worse. That's a for sure. They accept no fish or meat. They drink no liquor, wine, or fermented brew. They keep to one house, one morsel. They keep to two houses, two morsels. They keep up to seven houses and seven morsels. They live on one saucerful a day, on two saucerfuls a day, up to seven saucerfuls a day. They take food once a day, once every other day, up to once every 7 days. Thus, even up to once every fortnight. They dwell pursuing the practice of taking food at stated intervals. But do they subsist on so little, Satchika? No, Master Gotama, sometimes they consume excellent hard food and excellent soft food, taste excellent delicacies, drink excellent drinks. Thereby they again regain their strength, fortify themselves, and become fat. What they earlier abandoned, Satchika, they later gather again, that together again. That is how there is the increase and decrease of the body. But what have you learned about the development of mind? Then Satchika, the Nigantha's son, was asked by the Blessed One about the development of mind. He was unable to answer. Then the Blessed One told him, "What have you have just spoken about the development of the body, Satchika, is not development of body according to the Dhamma and the Noble One's discipline. Since you do not know what development of body is, how could you know what development of mind is? Nevertheless, Satchika, as to one who is undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind, and developed in body and developed in mind, listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, Venerable Sir," Satchika, the Nigantha son, replied. The Blessed One said this: "How, Satchika, is one undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind? Here, Satchika, pleasant feeling arises in an untaught ordinary person. Touched by that pleasant feeling, he lusts after pleasure and continues to lust after pleasure. That pleasant feeling of his ceases. With the cessation of the pleasant feeling, painful feeling arises. Touched by that painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. When that painful feeling has arisen, it invades his mind and remains because body is not developed. And when the painful feeling has arisen in him, it invades his mind and remains because his mind is not developed. Anyone in whom, in this double manner, arise pleasant feeling and invades his mind and remains because the body is not developed, and arisen painful feeling invades his mind and remains because mind is not developed, is thus undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind. And how, Satchika, is one developed in body and developed in mind? Here, Satchika, a pleasant feeling arises in a well-taught noble disciple. Touched by that pleasant feeling, he does not lust after it, after pleasure, or continue to lust after pleasure, that pleasant feeling of his ceases. With the cessation of that pleasant feeling, painful feeling arises. Touched by that painful feeling, he does not sorrow, grieve, and lament. He does not weep, beating one's breast, and become distraught. When that pleasant feeling has arisen in him, it does not invade his mind and remain, because his body is developed. So what we're talking about here is having equanimity when there's painful feeling or when there's pleasant feeling. So you have a balanced mind all the time. And when that painful feeling has arisen in him, it does not invade his mind and remain, because his mind is developed. Anyone in whom, in this double manner, arisen pleasant feeling does not invade his mind and remain, because his body is developed, and arisen painful feeling does not invade his mind, because his mind is developed, is thus developed in body and developed in mind. I have confidence in Master Gotama, thus Master Gotama is developed in body and developed in mind. Surely, Satchika, your words are offensive. He was trying to mock him when he said that. And discourteous, but I will answer you, since I shaved off my hair and beard and put on the yellow robe and went forth from the home life into homelessness. It has not been possible for a risen pleasant feeling to invade my mind and remain, or a risen painful feeling to invade my mind and remain. Has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so pleasant that it could invade his mind and remain? Has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so painful that it could invade his mind and remain? Why not, Satchika? Here, Satchika, before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisatta, the word bodhisatta means future Buddha, I thought, household is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It's not easy while living in a home to lead a holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard and put on the yellow robe and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessings of youth in the prime of life. Though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard and put on the yellow robe and went from the home life into homelessness, having gone forth, monks, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace. I went to Allura Kalama and said to him, Friend Kalama, I want to lead a holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Allura Kalama, the Venerable One may stay. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in, realize for himself with direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma, as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teachings. I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there are others that did likewise. I considered this is not through mere faith alone that Allura Kalama declares by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly, Allura Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Allura Kalama and asked him, friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge, you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma? He replied, he declared the base of nothingness. Now this is one-pointed concentration. Okay. This is a different kind of practice than what we're doing. I considered not only Allura Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Allura Kalama declares he enters upon and abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Allura Kalama and asked him, friend Kalama, is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma and by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend, it is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend. Let us now lead this community together. And one of the things that was really amazing at that time was the Brahmins didn't take on the robes until they had a family and they worked for a number of years, and then when they started getting gray hair, they got to be about 60 years old, then they would give everything to the family and put on the robes. To have somebody that was as young as Gotama, or Siddhartha Gotama, to do that while he was still young was very unusual. And to be that successful was really special, according to the way that they practiced at that time. Thus, Allura Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to Nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness. If you look on the chart in the dining hall, the base of nothingness lasts, when you're reborn in that realm, it lasts for 60,000 mahakapas. A mahakapa is, there's four parts to it. They're called asankhyas. There is the expansion of the universe and stopping for the same length of time. They say it's 10 to 160 zeros in human years. So it's a real long time. Whether that's really actually true, who knows? Anyway, so when the universe is expanding, that's when life in that universe comes into being. And then the planets will go out so far and then they'll stop for that same length of time that it took to get there. And then it will start contracting for another 10 to 160 years, and then it will stop for 10 to 160 years, and then the whole cycle starts over again. That's called a mahakapa. Now, if you never get any higher than the realm of nothingness, you will be reborn in that realm that lasts 60,000 mahakapas. That's a long time. David actually measured on his computer. What font did you have? 12? 12 point. And he measured how many zeros there were in 1 inch. The mahakapa lasted for 84,000. And that was about 60 miles of zeros. So you're talking about a pretty big number there. And this is a little bit less than that by 20,000 kapas. So it might be a few miles less, whatever. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, he left. Now, he tried the one point of concentration and got to nothingness, but he wasn't satisfied with it because he saw that there was still other stuff in his mind. His mind wasn't as pure as he wanted it to be. Still in search, monks, of what was wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Udaka Ramaputta and said to him, "Friend, I want to lead a holy life in this Dhamma and discipline." Udaka Ramaputta, the last name, means, Putta means the son of Rama. So Ramaputta was the son of Rama. "The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can sooner enter upon and abide in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teachings went. I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, 'I know and see.' and there were others who did likewise. I considered it is not through mere faith alone that Rama, not Udaka Ramaputta, the father, declared by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Rama abided knowing and seeing this Dhamma. When I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, friend, in what way did Rama declare that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma? In reply, Udama Ramaputta declared the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Now, at that time, during when the Bodhisattva was striving, that was as high as anybody could ever experience in meditation. So that gives you an idea of what we're learning here, because I have students that are sitting in the cessation or sitting in neither perception nor non-perception. So if you don't get any higher, you're going to be reborn. We're 60 miles of zeros in years. I considered not only Rama had faith, energy, mindfulness, collectedness, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge. Now the thing is, Udaka Ramaputta, the son, had not experienced that. Because when you get into that state, you see such subtlety of mind. There can be no doubt in your mind in a supreme being. There is supreme being, but it's not a supreme being. So you let go of all of your philosophies and belief in a permanent God. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, friend, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma by realizing for himself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. So Rama had told his son, this is the experience. But Udaka didn't want to go beyond nothingness where there was still the idea of a permanent God. What you start realizing when you get into neither perception nor non-perception is the subtlety of mind, which is really, really good. And you'll get into a space where you can sit for a long period of time without any disturbance in your mind at all. Nothing pulling you away. And that's getting close to the experience of Nibbana. But with one-pointed concentration, you never recognize what craving is, how to let craving go, and what the cessation of craving really means. So there's still that false belief in a personal self. When you experience the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, and you come back and you feel the relief and you see the little tiny movements of dependent origination, that is the realization of all conditioned things and how they arise and how they cease. That realization is so strong that it changes your perspective. And when it changes your perspective, you no longer will have any doubt as to what the correct path actually is. You will lose faith that rites and rituals will lead you to Nibbana. And you know for yourself that everything is part of an impersonal process. Although the craving is still going to be there a little bit, it's not going to be as strong. And you're going to be able to see more clearly how you cause yourself pain, and you will let go of that more quickly. There was a man that was, he actually sponsored me to go to Korea. And I taught, and this one woman had the experience of Nibbana. And everybody was real happy about that. Not very many people actually knew, but there was, they liked to gossip and they found out. But they didn't see any real personality change in her. And they said, well, how can she be sitting or having this experience? That wasn't the real experience. And I said, the only change you're going to see in her and recognize is that she's not going to break any precepts. And the only way you're going to know whether that's really true is you have to be around her all the time. For a period of, 6 months or so. So, they didn't believe that that was the experience of Nibbana, because they've heard Nibbana and there's supposed to be all these fireworks going off and there has to be, all of a sudden, they're going to be perfect in conduct and wisdom, and they're not. You're still going to have hindrances that you got to work with. They're still going to be coming up. They will until you become an arahat. So why do you expect somebody that had become a sotapanna that something as different is going to happen? Anyway, that is the way, friend. It is the way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have entered, or that we have such a venerable one for a companion in this holy life. So the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. So, you know the Dhamma that Rama knew, and Rama knew the Dhamma that you know. As Rama was, so are you. As you are, so was Rama. Come, friend, lead this community. So he was willing just to step down and let the Buddha take over because of his direct knowledge. Thus, Uddhama Ramaputta, my companion in the holy life, placed me in a position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor that he could. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment. Why? Because there's still craving in there. Subtle as it might be, it is still there. To dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to Nibbana, but only to reappear, a reappearance in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. Still in search, monks, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered in stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Uruvala. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks, and a nearby village for alms resort. A lot of people go to that spot. And the river is like polluted like you wouldn't believe. It's horrible brown water. The banks aren't very nice anymore. It wasn't a very pleasant sight. Anyway, I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with clear flowing water. It's not clear flowing anymore. A pleasant smooth banks in a nearby village for alms resort, a place to get food. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. Okay. Now, these three similes occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Satchika? Could that man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water? No, Master Gotama, why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood and it's lying in water. Eventually, that man would only reap weariness and disappointment. So too, Satchika, as to those recluses and Brahmins who still do not live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual pleasures, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned, and suppose internally, even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. This was the first simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Again, Satchika, a second simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Satchika? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? No, Master Gotama. Why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood, even though it's lying on dry land far from water. Eventually that man would reap only weariness and disappointment. Now this is describing other practices. They don't lead to Nibbana. So too, Satchika, as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, but whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual desires has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally, even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing pain due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. This was the second simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Again, Satchika, a third simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Satchika? Could that man light a fire and produce heat by rubbing against a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? Yes, Master Gotama. Why so? Because it's a dry, sapless piece of wood, and it's lying on dry land far from water. So too, Satchika, as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, and thirst and fever for sensual pleasures has been fully abandoned, suppressed internally. I don't like the word suppressed. Let go of is a better word. Even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feeling due to exertion, they're capable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. This is the third simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. These are the three similes that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched, my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. Now he's talking about persistent hindrances. There was a teacher who practices one-pointed concentration that decided he was going to do an 8-month self-retreat. And he wrote in the article after he got done with the retreat, he wrote it in a newspaper, he said, "The first 3 months I spent with my teeth clutched, my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth. I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind for 3 months. After 3 months, he finally let go of some of the hindrance. He still had the craving, but he finally was able to overcome the attachment as much as he could, and went on to have nice sittings after that. So, with my teeth clutched, my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind. While I did so, sweat ran from my armpits. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too, with my teeth clutched, my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits. Although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by this painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I went to Bhikkhu Bodhi." And this is in another sutta where it recommends you do this practice. "And I told him, you know, it's almost comical that somebody would think that that is the right way to practice meditation, constrain and push down anything. To my way of understanding, everything in Buddhism is about opening up and letting be, not keeping your attention on it, relaxing into it. That's how you overcome the hindrances." And he said, "Well," I said, only the first part of the sutta is worth being in the suttas, where it said you have to let go of unwholesome thoughts, develop wholesome thoughts. And what that basically means is practicing right effort. But constraining mind and pushing it down and crushing mind with mind is meaning that there is still some attachment there. And I told him, this first part of the sutta is fine. After that, all the rest of that is referring to one-pointed concentration. And it doesn't work. It refers to trying to overcome the hindrances by looking at other things, by trying to distract your mind in one way or another so the hindrance doesn't come up. And I said, it's laughable that people in Burma, this is one of their favorite techniques for overcoming hindrances. And I said, I don't have any students that ever have that problem. And he said, well, I've had that sort of thing where I had to crush mind with mind. And I said, and you have migraine headaches. You have a real problem with migraine headaches, right? And he said, yes. I said, well, that's one of the reasons that you have problems with it, because you're trying to suppress things with your concentration. And the Buddha's teaching doesn't ever talk about suppressing. It talks about allowing, not keeping your attention on it. That's why the six R's work, because it is right effort. And that's one of that is, they call it right effort. I don't like to use those words. I call it harmonious practice, because that's really what it is. It is harmonious practice. And you get more and more in harmony when the hindrances arise. People that practice one-pointed concentration, the hindrance is something to stop, to crush, to make it quit. When the hindrances, according to the Satipatthana Sutta, are a real important part of the practice to understand what happens to cause the hindrance to arise, what to do with the hindrances there, and once it's gone, how not have the hindrance arise again. So it's a lack of mindfulness that causes your go away from your object of meditation. You're not in a jhana anymore, even though you might feel like it. But you're not in the jhana, and you'll see this hindrance come up. What do you do when a hindrance arises? Six R. And how do you not have hindrances arise in the future? By staying with your object of meditation with mindfulness. Mindfulness is one of the most misunderstood words right now in this country, at least, and probably in Europe too. Because the psychologists and psychotherapists, they are putting their own definitions to it. I read an article that there was three major teachers from different traditions, and they were going to discuss with the interviewer what mindfulness is. And they went around what mindfulness is. They talked about mindfulness, but they never gave a direct definition. At the end of the article, the guy that was the interviewer, he wrote, well, I guess we're going to have to ask this question again. And these are three of the main teachers. I mean, they were really big teachers in this country. And they didn't give any kind of a clear definition of what mindfulness is. So I'm going to give you one that works 100% of the time. Mindfulness is remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. When you start looking at how it moves, you start looking more deeply and you stop identifying with the distraction whenever it comes. You use right effort. So it's a real important thing to understand that the importance of using the six R's is something that you need to incorporate in your daily life whenever your mind is distracted. There's times that you feel like you have to do 25 things and you only got 10 minutes to do it. You're caught by restlessness. Why are you caught by restlessness? Because your mindfulness disappeared. So, what do I recommend you do in your daily life when you have that kind of thing? When you have, oh, there's so many things to do. Sit down 5 minutes. Calm your mind, radiate loving kindness to all directions. After 5 minutes, your mind goes, becomes calm. Then you become super efficient at what you're doing. When you have that restlessness, you're doing this, you're thinking about something else, you don't do a good job with this, and you leave this alone because I got to do that one. And then you got to come back and finish what you did. So you're not very efficient with what you're doing while you're doing it. When your mind gets some balance in it and equanimity in it, then you become super efficient. And you do this, done. You're not thinking about the next task. You're just doing what needs to be done. And then you do the next one and the next one, and then you still have time left over. So this practice, what it does is it makes you very efficient at what you're doing while you're doing it, because you're not thinking about something else. You're just doing this. That means your mindfulness is very strong. So the Buddha really doesn't recommend this crushing mind with mind, because it doesn't work. Then we go on to something else. I thought, suppose I practice the breathless meditation. So I stop the in and out breaths through my mouth and nose. One of the things that they did in India, and to this day they still do if they're interested in the breathless meditation, is that little partition under your tongue, they cut it. And that way they can swallow their tongue. And that stops the breath from coming out of their mouth or nose. While I did so, there was a loud sound of winds coming out through my ear holes, just as there was a loud sound when the smith's bellows are blown, so too, while I stop the in-breaths and out-breaths through my nose and ears, nose and mouth it should read, there was a loud sound of winds coming out my ear holes. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm. And because I was exhausted by painful striving, but mindful, the painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth and nose and ears. While I did so, violent winds cut through my head, just as a strong man were to crush my head with the tip of a sharp sword, so too I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. Violent winds cut through my head. although unremitting energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought, uncalm, because I was exhausted by painful striving. But such painful striving that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So it didn't really affect his mind much, but his body just got very tired from all of the pain that arose. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, there were violent pains in my head, just as if a strong man were tightening a tight leather strap around my head as a headband. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, there were violent pains in my head. But although unremitting energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by painful striving. But such painful striving that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So he knew that it was just there. It didn't bother him. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, violent winds carved up my belly, just as if a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to carve up an ox belly with a sharp butcher's knife, so too. While I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, violent winds carved up my belly. But although unremitting mindfulness was aroused in me and unremitting energy was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by painful striving. But such painful striving arose in me and did not invade my mind and remain. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, there were violent burning in my body, just as if two strong men were to seize a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a fire of hot coals. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, there were violent burning in my body. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by painful striving. But such painful striving that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. Now, when deities saw me, some said, "The recluse Gotama is dead." Other deities said, "The recluse Gotama is not dead, he is dying." And other deities said, "The recluse Gotama is not dead or dying, he's an arahat, for such is the way of arahats abide." So, because the Buddha did this practice, I never even considered trying the breathless meditation. But he went to the end of it. He went as far as anybody could possibly go. And it still didn't lead him to Nibbana. So he gave that practice up. I thought, suppose I practice entirely cutting off food. Then deities came to me and said, "Good sir, do not practice cutting off food. Entirely cutting off food If you do so, we will infuse heavenly food into the pores of your skin, and you will live on. I considered, if I claim to be completely fasting, while these deities infuse heavenly food into the pores of my skin, and I live on that, then I shall be lying. So I dismissed those deities, saying, there is no need. I thought, suppose I take very little food. Now, this is a practice that happened in India during the time of the Buddha, and it's still around. A handful each time, whether it was bean soup or lentil soup or vetch soup or pea soup. So I took very little food, a handful each time, whether bean soup or lentil or vetch or pea soup. While I did so, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. I did an experiment when I was in Thailand. I was staying at a monastery, and the only way we got food was going out on alms round, and I stopped eating. I did take water and honey water. That's all I took. And I did it for 30 days. Mostly because I wanted to see if I could do it. And I lost 85 pounds. I was truly skin and bone. And if I tried to touch my stomach, I was hitting bone in my backbone. That's how skinny I really had become. I still had strength enough. There was a well where we got our water for taking a shower. And I could get a 5-gallon bucket down and bring it up. I still had strength enough to do that, but that was about it. It was like a full day's work to do that. And I wanted to go on further. I wanted to see if I could do it for 40 days. But the Thai were so upset that they literally forced me to start eating again, because they were bringing food and standing there until I would do something with the food. So I had to stop doing that. And that was an interesting experience, not one I highly recommend, but if there is a famine, I know I can last. So I don't have to worry, as long as there's good water. Water is really, really important when you're not taking food. And with a little bit of honey in it, it gives you enough energy, you can still do things. I didn't spend a whole lot of time outside, but when I got to Thailand and became a monk, I couldn't cross my legs like everybody else because I had an operation on this knee. I had to sit with one leg and going back. As I lost weight, I could do that. And that made all of the Thai very happy, all of the monks. Look, he can sit in meditation now like he's proper, like it's supposed to be. But in 2 weeks, I'd gained a lot of the weight back. I'd gained 35, 40 pounds back. Not because I was eating a lot, I wasn't. But I was getting back to the way I should have been. I got thin like that one other time. And I was in Burma. And when they told me that I was being lazy because I was taking 4 hours sleep a night, I started taking 2 hours sleep a night. and I was eating like you couldn't believe. And at breakfast, they had these fairly large bowls. I was eating three bowls and losing weight. And at lunch, I was stuffing myself, but it takes a lot of energy to stay up like that. And after 3 months of doing that, I had gotten down to, it was about 160 pounds. Now, I generally, at that time, I weighed about 190 pounds. So I lost quite a bit of weight. And my eyes had started to sink back in my head and all of these kind of things you get from not eating enough. When I got out of Burma, I basically slept for 6 weeks. I'd get up in the morning, do the morning service, go out on alms round, eat, took a nap. Got up around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, stretched, walked around a little bit. Maybe I'll take a nap. And I'd take a nap till 5 or 6 in the evening and get up and stayed up for a couple hours and then went to bed. I had to catch up on all of that lost sleep. Now, I recommend that, and this was forceful, what I was doing. I was pushing myself to do it. It wasn't natural. Now, I get right around 6 hours a night. And that's more than enough. And I can't sleep any longer. It depends what time I go to bed, of course. I'm a late night person, so I wind up going to bed around 1 o'clock and getting up around 7. But for you, when your mind calms down, you don't need as much sleep at that time. So I recommend that when you get up in the middle of the night, you start sitting. Sometimes you can't sit very long and you feel like going to sleep, then go to sleep. No big deal. But sometimes your meditation can be so good that you don't break your sitting. And you look at the clock and it's like you get up at 2 o'clock and you look at the clock and it's like 5:30. Oh, I got to come for the morning service. So you might have a long sit, but it doesn't feel like it's a long sit. It feels like it's 10 or 15 minutes or 20 minutes. You're shocked when you get up and start moving around. Wow, that was a long sit. I feel great. I have a lot of energy. But I still allow you the space to take a nap in the afternoon. You see, this is a walk in the park, what I'm teaching you. This is like so easy. What I did in Burma for 8 months, I did it for 5 months because I cut down. I went to bed at 11 o'clock, got up at 3 o'clock. Started meditating, meditated all the rest of the day until 11 o'clock at night, then started the whole thing over again. I did that for 5 months. And then the last 3 months I was there, I was told I was being lazy, so that's why I cut it down to 2 hours. Now here, I tell you, go to bed at 10 o'clock, and I know most people go to bed earlier, and I don't care. But you get up at 5 o'clock. That's 7 hours sleep. And after lunch, go take rest. come back into the meditation hall between 1 and 1:30. That's another hour and some. You're getting 8 hours of sleep. This is easy. So, it's a real easy, harmonious practice. When you do it naturally, and you get enough exercise, everybody, I talk to you about your exercise, I make you sure that you're doing your walking, and when you sit longer, you need to walk with more energy so that you get the blood that's settled in your legs moving up into your head. So say you sit for 3 hours. Great. I want you to walk in a way that you're breathing through your mouth for 10 or 15 minutes. And some people, I tell them to run up and down the stairs to get the circulation going. Your sitting is much better when you have that oxygen coming back into your brain. It's not other than meditation. Why? Because all life is meditation, and walking is part of life. Stay with your object of meditation. When your mind is distracted, okay, fine. Six arc, come back. Don't make it a big deal in your mind if you have a distraction. So it's a real important part of the day. The exercise time. Now you've heard me give some of the suttas, and people go out walking for exercise. That's a necessary part of the practice. You need to get enough exercise. I really don't recommend running, because that's hard on your ankles and your knees. But walking is much easier, and it's easy to stay with your object of meditation after you get used to it. Okay. Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. And that's what happened to me. My legs got very knobby. You could see all of the ribs and that sort of thing. Because of eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt and as crazy as rafters from an old roofless barn. Because of eating so little, the gleam in my eye sank down into their sockets, looking like the gleam of water that sunk far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered. That didn't happen to me. A green bitter gourd, like a green bitter gourd, shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. If you don't know what bitter gourd is, to my way of thinking, you're lucky. Although Sri Lankans really like it, a lot of Asians really like the bitter taste. I wasn't raised with a bitter taste. I don't like it so much. I eat it by accident. But I prefer to not eat it. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. That didn't quite happen to me, but I could feel my backbone through my abdomen. Thus, if I touch my belly skin, I encountered my backbone. And if I touch my backbone, I encountered the belly skin. Because of eating so little, if I defecated or urinated, I fell on my face there because of eating so little. If I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs and with my hands, the hair, the rotted at the roots, fell from my body as I rubbed. Now, when people saw me, some said, "The recluse Gotama is black." Others said, "The recluse Gotama is not black. His skin color was golden. But because of not eating, he turned black." "The recluse Gotama is not black, he's brown." Others said, "The recluse Gotama is neither black nor brown. He is golden-skinned." So much had the clear, bright color of my skin deteriorated through eating so little. I thought, whatever recluses or Brahmins in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. None can go beyond this and still live. And whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none that can go beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins at the present experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none that can go beyond this. But by this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to awakening? So he had 4 or 5 years of doing all of these austerities, and if I read you some of the austerities, these are some of the tamer kind of austerities that he did. If I read you the others, you would be thoroughly disgusted, because he was doing weird things, you know, sleeping on nails and things like that. That's just mild compared to some of the stuff that he did. To this day, there's people that believe that you can become, quote, enlightened by just holding your hand in the air like this. After you hold your hand in the air for a few days, all the blood goes out of your arm and the muscle deteriorates, and it's just a skeleton. And to bring the arm down is exceptionally painful. But that's how you bring your attention to, I have my hand in the air like that all the time. Well, other people will think I must be enlightened because I did this. There is a yoga practice where you stand on one leg all the time. It's good for your balance, at least. But I can't. How are you going to get enlightened just standing on one leg? I saw a YouTube of this man, and he was considered a very high holy man. He never walked anywhere. He did somersaults. And he did like 1,500 miles of somersaults. And it took him a long time to do it. But when you watched him do the somersault, he did it with bare shoulder, but he put a piece of cloth on one of the shoulders so that when he rolled, it didn't get rocks and stuff in him. And he was so concentrated and so into doing it that when it got time to stop at night, it took two or three people to hold him down so he wouldn't somersault. But he was considered a saint because he did some weird thing like that. So the Buddha thankfully did all of these things so I could read about it, so I didn't have to do it. And I'm really, really grateful for that, because I would have tried some of that stuff if I thought it would work. But thankfully I got into reading before I got into too much heavy practice. So I saw, nah, this doesn't work. Okay, good. Let's not do that one. But I went through my own kind of suffering doing the same one-pointed kind of concentration for 20 years. And now you're reaping the benefit, so you don't have to do it. You don't have to do that practice and then eventually find out, well, this doesn't work. I recalled when my father, the Sakyan, was occupied while sitting in a cool shade of a rose apple tree. Now he's talking about when his father went out on a plowing ceremony. Every year they plow the fields up. And the Bodhisattva Gautama was very young, some say he was only a year old, some say that he was 5 years old, whatever, it doesn't really matter. But he was left under this rose apple tree, and there was a couple of attendants. Now this plowing ceremony was like major party time for the whole village, or a whole realm, or city, whatever it was. And they saw that the Bodhisattva was resting peacefully, wasn't being rambunctious, and they left him alone. And he saw, now I have some quiet time without getting disturbed, and he sat in meditation. And he experienced the first jhana. Now, one of the major insights that he got from this experience was, you don't have to be afraid of joy. He did all of these ascetic practices trying to stop joy from coming up, and you don't have to be afraid of it. It's just part of the process. So, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought with joy and happiness born of seclusion. Now, he remembered this experience because his mind became very peaceful and calm. So the night of his awakening, he asked the question, could that be the path to awakening? Then, following on that memory, came the realization that indeed is the path to awakening. Now, he'd done so much meditation in past lifetimes that it had become a habit for him. And he experimented with many lifetimes with all different kinds of meditation practices. But this time he started using right effort, recognizing when there is a distraction, letting go of the distraction and relaxing, bringing up something wholesome, and I put in this extra little thing of smile, because when you smile, you improve your mindfulness. And it's easier to see when you smile, you start to have joy arise, and your mind becomes very alert, especially when your mind starts losing that joy. You can catch it more quickly, and then you can start smiling some more, and then go back up, and you let go of the hindrances. I thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and it has no unwholesome states? I thought, I'm not afraid of that pleasure, and since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states, I considered it is not easy to attain that pleasure with the body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I eat solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. And I ate solid food and boiled rice and porridge. Porridge is rice soup. When I go to Indonesia, I mostly just eat rice soup and put curries or whatever in with it and eat that way. Now, at that time, five monks were waiting upon me, thinking, if our recluse Gotama achieves any higher state, he will inform us. But when I ate boiled rice and porridge, the five monks were disgusted and left me, thinking, the recluse Gotama now lives luxuriously. He has given up striving and reverting to luxury. That's what the idea was, that you had to cut down on all of that sort of thing. Then, when I'd eaten solid food and regained my strength, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought with joy and happiness born of seclusion. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. With the stilling of thinking and examining thought, I entered upon and abided in the second jhana. With the fading away of joy, I entered upon and abided in the third jhana, which has equanimity, mindfulness, and full awareness. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, I entered upon and abided in the fourth jhana. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. In other words, he wasn't attached to it. When my collected mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfections, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. Now that is the description of what happens when you're in the fourth jhana. That's why I tell you, now you are an advanced meditator because you got to this state. Now, the way he attained awakening was through the recollection of past lives. He started developing his memory until he just kept going back and back and back and back. I recollected my manifold past lifetimes, that is, one birth, two births, a thousand births. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lifetimes. You remember what you did in a past lifetime, the kind of food you ate, the kind of clothes you wore, who your friends were. Now this is an interesting thing that happens, is you start recognizing people that you're really comfortable with now? Because we've been hanging out together in past lifetimes as brother or sister or father or mother, one of those kind of things. But it seems that all are a lot of different people. When you meet them, you feel like you've known them for a long time. That's because you have. And you've been friends with them. I have some very, very close friends that when I first met them, I was very comfortable with them. We've been friends for over 40 years. Sometimes there's a gap of 20 years between not seeing each other. But when we get together, it's like there was no time passed. That's really kind of an amazing thing. This was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. The first watch of the night is 7 o'clock at night until 11 o'clock. The second watch of the night is 11 o'clock until 3 o'clock. The third watch of the night is 3 o'clock until 7 o'clock. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and radiance arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, hearted, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. When my collected mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfections, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, that means equanimity, I directed it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings, which means he developed his divine eye, and he could go see these different realms, and the divine ear, so he could communicate with people in the different realms. What did you do to get into this realm? What kind of activity did you do? And that was in not only the heavenly realms, but also in the hell realms. There's a story about the hell realms that I'd kind of like to tell. This guy died, and he was met at the pearly gates, if there is such a thing. And his guide said, okay, you've lived a good life, and you've done some bad things in the life. Now I'm going to give you a choice. Where do you want to be reborn? So he takes them to this realm, and people are sitting around, and they're singing and dancing and eating food and just generally frolicking. And then he said, okay, let's go to this other realm. And he goes to this other realm, this hell realm, and he sees this room where people are whispering to each other, but they're standing in excrement up to their lower lip. Okay, where do you want to be reborn? Up to you. And the guy's curiosity was so strong, he wanted to know what they were whispering to each other. So he picked that and he got into it and he walked close to somebody else. And he found out what they said to each other. Don't make waves. So that's what curiosity does for you. Be careful. With this divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. I understood how beings pass on according to their actions. This was the second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished. True knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and radiance arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. When my collected mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfections, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. In other words, he saw how dependent origination worked. I directly knew, as it actually is, this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Now, what he actually saw was the Four Noble Truths in every one of the links of dependent origination. He saw how conditioned things cause other conditions to arise. And when they cease, those other conditions. So when it says here that he saw the Four Noble Truths, he was seeing that in each of the links of dependent origination. So he saw this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. These are the taints. This is the origin. This is the cessation. This is the way leading to the cessation of the taints. When I knew and saw thus, this is when the realization of Nibbana occurred. My mind was liberated from the taint of sensual pleasure, sensual desire, from the taint of being, from the taint of ignorance. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge, it is liberated. I directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. That's the highest awakening that you can experience. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, true knowledge arose, darkness was banished, and radiance arose, as happens in one who is diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. Satchika, I recall teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of hundreds, and even then each person thinks of me. When they think of me, the recluse Gotama is teaching the Dhamma especially for me. But it should not be so regarded. The Tathagata teaches the Dhamma to others only to give them knowledge. When the talk is finished, Satchika, then I steady my mind inwardly, quiet it, bring it to stillness, and collect it. With collected mind on it, that same sign of collectedness as before, in which I constantly abide. After he gave a Dhamma talk, he got into the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. This is a matter about which Master Gotama can be trusted. As an accomplished, fully awakened one should be. But does Master Gotama recall sleeping during the day? I recall, Satchika, in the last month of the hot season, on returning from my alms round, after my meal, I lie down on the outer robe folded in four, And lying down on my right side, I fall asleep mindfully and fully aware. Some recluses and Brahmins call that abiding in delusion, Master Gotama. Remember the definition of delusion I gave you is taking things personally, but he's not talking about this kind of definition. He's talking about somebody that's confused. It is not in such a way that one is deluded or undeluded, Satchika. As to how one is deluded or undeluded, then listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, sir, Satchika, the Nigantha son replied. The Blessed One said this, him I call deluded, who has not abandoned the taint that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future rebirth, aging, and death. For it is in this non-abandoning of the taints that one is deluded. The taint of craving and ignorance, those two. Him I call undeluded, who has abandoned the taints that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. For it is with the abandoning of the taints that one is undeluded. So, every time you use the six R's, your mind is undiluted at that time. That is called Nibbana. Ni meaning no, Bana meaning fire. Craving is always referred to by the Buddha as fire. Why? Because when you can really see craving when it first starts to arise, you see there's heat and then there's light. And that is the heat of craving. Nibbana is called cool. No fire, no heat, no craving. Every time you use the six R's, you are experiencing, for a brief moment, no fire, no craving, no clinging, no habitual tendency, no suffering. Just for a short period of time. Bring that mind to something wholesome. Smile. Bring that smiling mind that's light and very alert back to your object of meditation. And that's why you start progressing more and more quickly as you understand the necessity of smiling, not taking things personally, laughing, having fun with the meditation. That's something you're not going to hear other meditation teachers talk about. They want to talk about suffering. They want to talk about the pain of it. Well, that's the wrong way to teach, according to the Buddha. According to the Buddha, you talk about the cessation of suffering and how to get to the cessation of suffering. One of the reasons that Buddhism is starting to decline worldwide is because the monks are taking so much time talking about suffering. And they don't really understand what the cause of suffering is. It's desire. Well, I'm here to tell you that that's not right. It's craving. You have to be able to recognize what craving is when it arises, what to do with the craving when you see it, and how to not have it arise again. Staying with the wholesome mind that is on your object of meditation. One of the interesting things that you're not going to hear much in the way of meditators or practicers or teachers of most meditation, you're not going to hear, you need to laugh when you get caught by a hindrance. As soon as you laugh at how crazy your mind can be, when you laugh with, and I'm not talking out loud laugh, I'm talking about laugh with your mind about being dumb, about being stupid. When you laugh with that, you go from, I am sad, fearful, full of hatred, whatever, to, well, it's only this fear, or anxiety, or hate. So it changes your perspective, changes your view of the world. You let go of the craving, I am mad, to, it's only this anger. You want to carry it around with you? You can. Or easier just to let it go. Too many times, people that teach meditation teach how to put more effort and energy in how to overcome hindrances when they arise. They put too much emphasis on, you gotta try harder. There's a Burmese monk that I practiced with for a year, and when I went to interviews with him, how many times do you note something until it goes away? Well, there's 50,000 seconds in a day. If you're not noting 50,000 times, you're not doing enough. He's the same teacher that told me that I was being lazy by taking 4 hours sleep. I was a good student. Whatever they said I needed to do, that's what I did. And I suffered for it for 20 years. And I'm suffering for it to this day because I had a teacher that kept on telling me, sit longer, sit longer, sit longer. I sat 6 to 8 hours a day, or at one time, without moving. Developed blood clots in my legs because I was pushing it. Now, I have students that sit long. Don't get me wrong. One of my students, the first meditation he did when I went to Indonesia and he took the first retreat, he sat for 15 hours. No moving. 15 hours. I don't recommend it. But he wanted to see how long he could do it. Three or four hours is more than enough. You can really progress very well when you do that. I had another student that she progressed in her meditation so well that at the end of the retreat she sat for 9 hours. That's longer than I could sit. But I was taught to force myself to sit that long. and I develop blood clots. What do I tell you when you're sitting long? You have to get more exercise. You have to walk more. What did they tell me to do? Well, you have to walk really slowly. Really slowly. So I got no real exercise at all. I mean, when I talk about walking slowly, from that wall to that wall would take me about 45 minutes to walk one time, one direction. That's how slowly I was walking. And it hurt my body because of that. And that was when he was telling me to do that, that was 1992. And I've had problems with swelling in my ankles and my legs ever since, because the valves got stuck open. So now the blood goes in just right, gets pumped back up, but there's no valve to stop it from going back down. So now I have swollen ankles and swollen feet. And that's why you see me kind of walking gingerly, because it is such a painful thing that I've been to every kind of healer that you can think of. I mean, I had acupuncture for, well, that was about 4 or 5 years while I was in either Malaysia or Indonesia. And Korea. Doesn't seem to affect it one way or the other. Can't get those valves to close up. They are coming out with a new kind of magnetic electro energy. And I'm about ready to give that one a go. But I have to hear more about the positive effects of it first. Anyway. Okay, Satchika, the Tathagata has abandoned the taints that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. He's cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them so that they're no longer subject to future arising. Just as a palm tree whose crown is cut off is incapable of further growth, so too the Tathagata has abandoned the taints that defile, done away with them so that they're no longer subject to future arising. When this was said, Satchika the Nigantha's son said, "It is wonderful, Master Gotama, it is marvelous. How, when Master Gotama is spoken to offensively again and again and assailed by discourteous courses of speech, the color of his skin brightens, the color of his face clears, as to be expected of one who is accomplished and fully awakened." That is really amazing coming from him. There are other suttas talking about how truly offensive he really was. "I recall Master Gotama engaging with Purana Kasapa in debate, and then he prevaricated, led the talk aside, and showed anger, hate, and bitterness. But when Master Gotama is spoken to offensively again and again, insulted by discourteous courses of speech, The color of his skin brightens and the color of his face clears, as to be expected in one who's fully awakened. I recall Master Gotama, and he goes through a list of the other big teachers at the time. And he even asked Nigantha Naputa, the head of the Nigantas, in debate. And then he prevaricated and let the talk aside and showed anger, hate, and bitterness. But Master Gotama is spoken to offensively again and again, and assailed by discourteous courses of speech, the color of his skin brightens, the color of his face clears, as to be expected in one who is accomplished and fully awakened. And now, Master Gotama, we depart. We are busy and have much to do. Now is the time, Satchika, to do as you think fit. Then Satchika, the Nigantha's son, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, got up from the seat and departed. So this gives you an idea of some of the things that the Buddha went through that were ascetic practices thought to lead to Nibbana. And none of them actually did until he gave up his bodhisattvahood and became a Buddha. It's really kind of amazing to think of somebody with a mind like that, that never had craving or ignorance arise in his mind. So any kind of question you ask him, even if you ask him in an offensive way, he gave you the Dhamma that would help clear up your thinking. He truly was the master. He was real good to be around. And I hope you realize that we are so lucky to be reborn this close to a Buddha, that his teaching is still in reasonably good shape. There's some problems with translations, and monks will argue this point or that, but it's still in reasonably good shape, enough so that you can still attain Nibbana in this very life. When it started happening on a more regular basis when I was in Indonesia, I started giving people a towel when they attained Nibbana. They fell in the stream. So I gave them a towel so they could dry off. Remember that? Don't do that anymore. Because I'd have to buy hundreds of towels. So, do you have any questions? Yeah.
How many other teachers are there that follow what you think is the correct way of teaching?
I don't know. Not many. Almost everybody that's teaching is teaching one form or another of absorption or one-pointed kind of concentration. And they have their own formula for what they say attaining Nibbana really is, that doesn't agree with what the Buddha was teaching in the suttas. It's hard to tell. Starting to get a lot of students now that are starting to have the ability, because of their own practice, to teach. And Doug Kraft, he was my student. And I told him that he could start teaching. He gets a little confused sometimes because he doesn't follow what it says in the book as closely as he could. And he was a minister for 15 years before he became Buddhist. And I'm not sure he would even consider himself being a Buddhist right now. He's very much into his psychoanalysis, psychology kinds of things. When I give a retreat, like I go to California, now I'm going to be going twice a year, and I'm going once in Florida for a 10-day retreat, in this country, it's about 40% of the people, if they follow the directions like I show them, are able to attain Nibbana, at least become a Sotapanna. In Indonesia, because I've been going there for 7 years now, percentage is quite a bit higher. Right now there's 25 people that are so enthusiastic with the practice and their success in the practice that they're starting to teach, which is really good for me, so I don't have to go to Indonesia as often. And I think I'm going to quit this year. They don't need me there. I need the time to go someplace else. But this practice is so amazing that it's starting to go to very obscure kinds of countries that you never would think had any Buddhist in them at all. I don't really like calling them Buddhist. They're practicing the Buddha's method. Whether they call themselves something else or not, it doesn't really matter. But there's people in Romania that are practicing. There's people in Hungary that are practicing. There's people in Norway that are practicing. There's people in Russia that are starting to practice. There's a guy that is a very excellent writer. The first book he wrote sold over 1 million copies in Russia. And he's doing the translations now and putting it in subtitles underneath all of, or I don't know if it's all, well, a lot of the YouTubes. Yeah. And we have somebody in Spanish that's doing the same thing. I thought we found somebody that was going to do it in French, but we haven't run across anybody that is interested in that so much from France. There's people that are successful, but they've come here. When they go back, I don't know if they're teaching or doing anything with the teaching. I'm sure they're doing a little bit. But they're not interested in, quote, being a teacher. This country, everybody wants to be a teacher. And it just doesn't work. To be a teacher means you have to be able to say the same thing over and over and over again with the same kind of enthusiasm. These suttas that I read to you, I've said these suttas hundreds of times. But I still hear new things while I'm reading it. That's what a true teacher is all about. But I'm not, quote, the teacher. The Buddha is the teacher. I am a guide. I keep you on the path. If you're not doing, you're falling off the path, I'm going to try my best to get you back on the path. So, it's growing. Now I have to go from one end of the country to the other. And that's okay, but I don't want to spend so much time in Indonesia. Most of the time when I go to Indonesia, I have to give four retreats in 3 months. And with the traveling and the talks, it's real tiring. The last talk I gave in Indonesia was out on this island, and there was 500 people there, and you could hear a pin drop. They were so interested. I said something about one of the points of Buddhism was to be happy, and they all started clapping. And that never happens in a Dhamma talk. Anyway, I've been talking for a real long time.
So how often do you go to Sri Lanka?
I will be going in October. We haven't set up a regular schedule. There's an awful lot of monks that have resistance to this teaching. They want to keep things the way they want them. They want to argue about things. And the Sri Lankan, it's a real interesting situation because the Sri Lankan language has a lot of Pali words, but there's not great definitions. So the monks have put definitions on some of the words that are misleading. And that has to be cleared up. Every time I go to Sri Lanka, I get on television and I spend a couple hours, questions and answers, things like that. When I go to Indonesia, I wind up being on the radio, which is, there's only about 9% of the population that's Buddhist in Indonesia, but 9% of 200 million people is a big number. And because these 25 people they're going to be going out, they're training themselves right now, they're going to be going out and teaching. So that number is going to grow. Because this is so simple and it works. So they really don't need me coming there anymore. Of course, they always want me to come.
I'm only
discriminating. Yeah. They're doing it on me. I need to harmonize my image, my way to someplace else. But
what rushes nice that time of year?
Are you kidding me? We're talking about, I go there to get out of the winter here. So I go spend a little while in paradise.
Well, they're giving away free land now, and that's the current thing. So we could build a monastery in Siberia. It's a possibility.
Okay, you're going. You don't need me.
That's right, you've got enough. Zero.
Oh, I've been to Russia once.
No, I mean to the monastery.
Oh, yeah, well. But I've been told quite a few times I should be going to China. And I have resistance going to China. there's so many people there and so many things that are difficult in the cities, like breathing, things like that. I suppose I might go, I don't know. And I have been invited to go to India and turned it down, because they wanted me to stay there for 3 years. No, I can't do that. I'm a traveling monk. So I have to keep traveling. And I won't go back to Singapore because the government puts such restrictions on monks that you can't just give an open talk. You have to have a permit. That's too difficult. And you have to have permission from the government to stay in one of the monasteries. And you have to have all this paperwork before you go there. And I've been invited there. Please come. Well, if I can't give a Dhamma talk there, why would I go? I can't give a retreat there. But I'll go back to Malaysia again one of these times. They were really, really pushing for me to go back to Malaysia. I spent a lot of time in Malaysia. I have a lot of friends. And I just have to wait for the right time. The monk that might be coming, the Sri Lankan monk Punaji, is the head Dhamma speaker in Malaysia, at Brickfields. He's always giving Dhamma talks there and that sort of thing. I was shocked to hear that he came back to America, because the last time I saw him, he was not doing well. And the doctor told him, you cannot fly on the airplane anymore. But I guess he's kind of ignoring that. He is getting very old. He's 86, I think. But I owe him a lot, and that's why I want him to come, so I can give some back. He was the monk that told me to put down the Visuddhimagga and use it as a reference and just start learning the Dhamma language from the suttas.
Does he teach 6 hours?
No, he doesn't. And he doesn't agree with the relaxed step. He's changed a lot of his views from when I knew him. When did I meet him? It must have been 1995. He's changed a lot of his views about things. And some of the changes that he's made, I'm not real thrilled with. He's starting to change the ideas of the dependent origination. And we're going to have some pretty major discussions about that sort of thing. But it will all be very civil. And we have on occasion agreed to disagree. So he has his way of thinking and doing things, and I have the sutta way of thinking and doing things. He's more of a scholar than an actual practicer. Sometimes he does meditation for about 15 minutes, and that's it. So be restless. This is
36.
Nijima Makaya, 36.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the greatest hits list.
There's a book right back there.
Yeah, I wrote a small book of it. But I took out all of the ... and all the repeating is in it, in the book, plus explanation.
Is this the main sutta that describes the Buddha's awakening?
No, there's bunches of them.
Same, similar thing.
Similar. This and Sutta number 26 talk about his experience in meditation before he became the Buddha. They're the main ones for that. And it's pretty interesting. If you want to see some of his ascetic practices, it'll make your stomach not happy. Number 12. I didn't mention some of the bad stuff that he did. I mean, it was really nasty. Anyway. I'm done.
Okay.
Let's share some merit. May suffering ones be suffering free and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.